have a little introduction on here. Okay. I can hear right away if it's going all right. This is Mae Warren. Today is the 26th of April, 1996. I'm at Washington and Lee University with Dr. Pamela Simpson. And you can talk a little bit.
What do you want me to say?
Oh, good. Your laugh comes through loud and clear.
Good.
I want to know, what attracted you to this place in the first place?
Oh, I needed a job. I was finishing my PhD at the University of Delaware, and the way you get a job in my field is that you read the placement bulletin from the College Art Association, and there was a listing in there for I'm an Americanist who could also do modern and could also teach architecture. And it was a small liberal arts college in the South. And I thought, well, this looks like it's tailor-made for me. So I sent off my credentials and got a very positive response, got invited down for an interview, and absolutely fell in love with the place. You know, as someone who'd worked with American architecture, I felt that I was falling into a treasure trove. The amazing thing was, you know, I accepted that job in the, it was about January probably, and then, you know, arrived on campus that summer, and the cover of Antiques magazine had Washington and Lee's campus on it, and I'd walk around with my friends like, hey, here, look, this is the place I'm teaching, you know, but it had just been declared a National Historic Landmark, and they had, in the fall, they had all the events and governor here and the plaques and all the rest of it.
Tell me about that.
Well, it was really exciting. I was shocked when I came down here. They wanted me to teach a history of modern architecture, which I certainly could do. But I said to Professor Dayon, who was taking me around, I said, with all you have here, why don't you teach American architecture? And he said, well, if you come here, maybe you can teach American architecture. And then unbeknownst to me, he went ahead and made the provisions for me to be able to do that. So that very first year when I was here, I could teach American architecture and started a pattern that I've done ever since, which is to involve the students in doing research on local buildings, because I just thought this community was so rich in what it had to offer. And I started getting the kids involved in doing research on individual buildings, and I'm still doing it here, somewhat 23 years later.
So what year was this that you arrived?
1973, in the fall of 73, and it depends on how you figure it, but I was the first woman hired for a regular tenure track teaching, full-time teaching position in the undergraduate school, right? The reason you got to do all that is, as far as I can find out in the work I've done, is that until 1966, there was a policy that it was an all-male faculty. And in that year, one of the members of the theater department was going on leave, and his wife had a master's degree in theater. I mean, another theater department person had a wife with a degree. And they wanted her to take the sabbatical position. And they actually had to change the rules in order for her to do that. Well, then from 66 to 73, there'd been a number of women who had come on temporary appointments or sabbatical replacement positions. But as far as we consider, as first one, you know, full-time tenure track, there were also women in the library, on the library staff, who had faculty status and taught the one-credit bibliography class. So you could, you know, depending on how you want to do it, right? Mm-hmm. They were, you know, earlier, they had broke the ice, they'd certainly presented the idea that women could be teachers. So I felt that I had plenty of predecessors before me by the time I got here.
Did you have any sense of being a pioneer?
Oh, yeah, I certainly did. In fact, Gerard Doyon was the one who made that very clear to me. In fact, even to the point where in getting the soliciting the letters of recommendation from people, he had put that in that letter that this was a very important position because I would be the first woman full-time, you know, teaching at Washington and Lee. And so he wanted the people to express themselves as to how they thought I'd fit into that. I had one of my advisors call me saying, what do you think I should say? I mean, does he want me to say that you're happily married? You know, that, you know, it was like he didn't even really know what was behind all of that. And I said, nah, tell him how I adjust to things. And, you know, I think I did. I'm fond of telling the story about that first year that one of the great things about the South, and certainly about the gentlemanly tradition of Washington and Lee, is that no matter what they think about you or maybe saying about you behind your back, they're very polite to your face. And that's a level of civilization, the kind of decorum that controls that sort of politeness. And if you're the new person on the block, it actually made it a lot easier to get along because everything was, you know, pretty polite. To me, the real moment that came home, though, was at the very end of the year when I went to a cocktail party at Al Mosher's house, who was one of the grand old men in the history department and who had been a tremendous support for me all year long. And I felt like I had a really good friendship with this man and that he had been a wonderful support. And he got a little drunk at the cocktail party, and he threw his arm around me, and he said to another one of our colleagues we were talking to, "You know, I thought bringing women here was a great mistake, but Pam has changed all my prejudices." Well, you could have knocked me on the floor, because I didn't know the man had any prejudices. You know, and that may be part of what I'm talking about, is the graciousness of it. But it also, at the same time, shocked me, because it meant that I'd been on trial and hadn't necessarily known it. Well, I'm sure I knew I was on trial, but I didn't know it was for Al Mosher. And it sort of reinforced for me that, you know, there you were being measured in a lot of ways you weren't necessarily aware of. But I was aware of it. My other favorite story about those early years is that Henry and I, you know, faced this thing about, were we going to have a family? And one of the great cliches at the time was that you didn't hire a woman because she'd get pregnant and quit on you, or she wasn't able to fulfill her responsibilities. So that was really considered in many people's minds to be a legitimate reason not to hire women in the first place. So as a pioneering woman in that situation, I was very sensitive to not being, letting that be used against me. And when we finally decided, after I was here, it was so calculated. I'm just amazed when I think back about it and think how calculated it all was. But I was, I decided I was here for 2 years. I had established myself. I had good teaching credentials. I'd started to do some professional things that were important. I think I was getting along with everyone. So at that point, we thought it was okay. We could plan a family. Well, we did rhythm in reverse, with me taking my temperature every day for September, October, and November, so that the kid could be conceived and born in, well, he could be born in June, July, or August, so it wouldn't interfere. And we made it in October, right? Hooray, this is it. And I didn't tell anybody on campus that I was pregnant until I was 5 months. Part of it was I had to do a major presentation on the sculptor that I did my dissertation on at a conference in Philadelphia, and I wanted to get that out of the way before I coped with all of this. And I have to admit, I even chose Dr. Fox out in Fairfield as my doctor, because I didn't want to go to the one gynecologist in town, because I figured if I walked in his door, you know, that everybody would know what you were there for. So I went to the GP out in Fairfield, so it'd be a little more discreet. For 5 months, I'd finished the paper, I'd done all this. I walked into Dean Watt's office and I said, "I just want to tell you I'm pregnant and it's none of your business. And I want you to know that it's not going to interfere with my job." And Bill, to the dearest man on the face of earth, goes, "Oh, that's wonderful news. Oh, congratulations. I'm so pleased for you. Don't worry about it. This is perfect. Oh, we're so excited about this. You know, Helen asked me the other day if you were pregnant." And I loved it, you know, and that kind of, you know, sometimes because I felt like, you know, whether or not the university ever hired another woman depended on whether I worked out. I think I was a little defensive about some of those things. But what I met were people like Bill Watt, who were just so wonderful, so embracing, so supportive. And Bill eventually became one of my great mentors. When I went into the dean's office, he was absolutely the most wonderful person I've ever worked with in my life. And, you know, the university is full of people like that. You just want me to keep on talking?
You're
non-stop?
Wonderful.
I thought that was the second.
Of course
let
I
me,
do.
Let me get a drink of tea here.
Yeah, you can take a breath for a moment.
Well, don't you make sure you're asking me questions along the way that you want, you know,
you're
fill these out.
That's great.
Tom Wolfe didn't do this for you, huh?
Oh, not quite. Well, he wasn't to the point as well as you are.
Yeah.
Kept talking about clothing. What a surprise, right?
Well, you know, clothing, I'll never forget that that very first meeting we had as faculty. Sandy Keith, who was the wife of an English department member, was teaching math for the school as a sabbatical replacement. And she and I were the only two women here on the undergraduate teaching faculty. And so we sort of clubbed together a lot. But I remember sitting with her in that meeting, and one of the other male faculty members, new faculty members, asked Bill, what's appropriate dress for teaching? And Bill was standing up there in his pinstripe suit and tie and said, what I'm wearing. And Sandy and I looked at each other and shook our heads and said, nah. So it was like that. And, you know, and Bill laughed, too, when he saw us do that. So there were always little bits of things like that.
So what was the reaction of the students when, I guess you're saying that there were women already walking into the classroom, but was there a sense that the students had any problem with being taught by women?
Well, I was amused. One kid called me up at one point, said he desperately wanted to get into a class that already had too many students in it, and I was saying, I'm sorry, the class is closed, and he goes, oh, come on, this is my senior year, this is my only chance to have a woman as a teacher, don't you want to let me in? This is great. they're going to use everything, right? I don't know. I think I did feel, to some extent, there were some students who, because I was one of the few women on campus, there certainly were secretaries that I think had fulfilled this role for a lot of people. Marjorie Poindexter had in particular. But, you know, there was a certain femaleness missing in their lives in terms of a nurturing aspect. And I think there certainly were students who looked on me as a kind of mother figure, and I formed some very close relationships with students in those first couple of years where, you know, I remember this one kid who would come in and talk to me in my office, and to the point where I'd sometimes just have to say, I'm sorry, David, I have to go home, and then he'd follow me all the way out to the parking lot until I'd finally, like, gotten in the car and said, sorry, and then I had to shut the door in order to get away from you. I mean, I think that kid was really lonely, and that was clearly the problem, and that was certainly only in his freshman year. He made more advancements after that. But, you know, I was just someone that he felt he had a sort of sympathetic rapport for. And I got to tell you, seriously, about that kid, he ended up becoming a museum professional. We're colleagues now, so, you know, he had found the right person when he was obsessive about that stuff. But I think the real shocking one was a kid that I'd had in several classes during that first year and had really liked. And he was the sweetest kid from Little Rock, you know, one of that wonderful Southern accent and laid-back style, you know, just real Southern mush all over the place. And I love this kid. He was so neat. But he came in at the end of the year, right before he was going to graduate, and he said, you know, I just got to tell you, Miss Simpson, I never thought I could learn from a woman, but I have from you. It's like, what? You never thought you could learn from a woman? What? Would you say that to your mother? That you know,
right.
But you did run into things like that. So
what's the Southern aspect of WNL? Is it still, was it more prominent when you first came? Is it still...
I don't know.
That's,
I mean, I think that's something really hard for me to identify, but it's certainly something that's here. You know, there's that joke about how many Virginians it takes to change light bulbs, and it's three because one changes the bulb and two have to talk about how good the old one was. There certainly is that sense of tradition that's here that makes it, oh, I think a very permeating aspect of this place. And I'll admit, I came down here probably a little bit like a kind of Yankee revisionist. You know, I grew up in the Midwest, but I found out when you came to the South, no matter where you were from, you were Yankee if you weren't from the South. And my favorite one was, this is a little bit of an aside, talking, I lived that first year in the house that's right between SAE and Pi Phi, and I got to know a number of the SAE kids very well, and a number of them have been in my classes too, but one of the kids told me, he said, "You know, Miss Simpson, you're a good teacher, but you talk too fast. Even the boys from Baltimore say you talk too fast." And I thought, you know, that's as far north as their sensibilities went, you know. And I suppose in some ways that what has happened to me as a result of the South is I've slowed down. I talk a little slower, particularly in the classroom. But I think there is that aspect of a kind of greater ease and deliberation, a sense of time to do things that may be part of the South. It certainly makes it one of the most pleasant places to live. And I'll say that, too. This absolutely, this is the most wonderful place I have ever lived in my whole life. I grew up in Iowa, Nebraska. I got my undergraduate degree at Gettysburg. I got my master's degree in Missouri and my PhD at Delaware and lived in Philadelphia while I was doing that. And I've probably now, since 73 now, I've lived here longer than I've lived any other single place in my life. And this is home. I adore this place. And in fact, there were a couple times when I've had a chance to, you know, interview for other jobs and things like that. And I just, well, why would you want to leave paradise? I mean, it's really hard to imagine any place better than this, right here. And that's the way I continue to feel about it.
Right, this is an aside, but do you think there's any connection with that feeling and why a building was once called paradise?
A building was called paradise?
You know that.
Oh, what is that?
It's in your
Tell
book.
Me. I've forgotten it.
What? One of the little buildings that was on stuck on the back of Washington College building?
That was a joke, wasn't it? I think that was actually a...
One was purgatory well, and one was paradise.
Yeah, they were the names of two dormitories that were on either side of the center building for mm-hmm. a while, but then got replaced in mm-hmm. the 1840s by Robinson and Tucker. Now, I think that was purely a sense of student irony, that these were probably terrible places to live. And they were making jokes from their classical education about them. No, I mean paradise in the sense that I just can't imagine being happier any other place than here.
Well, you know, one of the things I was struck by when I first moved here was how many alumni live here.
Yeah.
I was struck immediately by how well-educated the carpenters in this area are.
Mm-hmm.
People don't want to leave.
Yeah. Well, I think that may be true in a lot of college towns, especially small college towns, the real pretty ones. I mean, yeah, I think you'd see the same kind of thing in Chapel Hill. I certainly saw the same kind of thing in Gettysburg. You get attached to a place, and sometimes the attachment becomes strong enough that you're willing to, you know, do some alternative things in order to stay there. Some people have claimed that's why we have so many lawyers in town, too.
Mm-hmm.
They graduate from WNL, don't want to leave.
I do wonder what they all do.
Yeah.
You mentioned the name Marjorie Poindexter.
Right.
Tell me about her. I've heard mention of her before.
I actually did a little research on this recently when Anise McLeod asked me something about the history of black women at Washington and Lee. And so I got on the phone with some colleagues and Ted Delaney, and we talked about it a bit and found that actually, the presence of black women on campus with staff positions started at exactly the same point of integration. That 1966-67 decision to integrate the university, bring the first black student on campus, was also exactly the same moment that they brought the first black secretaries on campus. And the very first woman was a woman who's still here in Lexington. Her name is Pooh Roane. R-O-A-N-E. I tell you the truth, I don't know what her first name is. I've heard it, but everybody calls her Pooh. She works at the bank. But she was hired as the secretary for the art department. So it was Gerard Doyon had that honor. Right? He hired the first black secretary on campus. Then he hired me, right? The first woman, you know, kind of thing, undergraduate. He was terribly proud of having done those things. But she was the first, and Marjorie was the second. Marjorie came the year after that. And she first worked for Van Pate in the financial aid office. And again, Marjorie was just one of the most incredibly mothering, nurturing people. She had this lively personality and was just adored by every single person who knew her. And she I think, had plenty of opportunity to do that in the financial aid department, where, you know, kids who were in need and suffering in other ways, too, were coming to her. But then she eventually became the Jim Whitehead secretary. And so he was the treasurer and the secretary to the board of trustees, and so she had a very prominent role there. And her office, when she was doing that, when I first came here, it was right in the front of Washington Hall, so it was divided up a little differently than it is now. But she was one of the first physical presidents you met when you came into Washington Hall, and she was just fantastic. She was so lively, she was so much fun. She was so helpful to everyone. But, you know, even today, if you asked anybody who knew her, you would find stories about Marjorie. She died really tragically, though. I mean, she died of a cerebral hemorrhage, and you know, she was sitting at her desk and fell over. And, God, it was devastating to all of us. But
when was that?
You know, I'm trying to remember exactly when it was. Might have been in the early 80s.
Yeah, I'd like to have a chat with her.
Yeah.
I think would be an interesting person.
Her husband's gone too.
Well, the context in which I heard about her before is this idea that she was so nurturing to the black students.
Well, she was, but she was nurturing to everybody.
Okay, what was your sense by the time you got here in 73? Were black students assimilating?
In 73? Yeah, actually, the first year I was here, they had a man who was the director of minority affairs who wasn't very effective, and he left by the end of that year. He was a little strange, too. Then they replaced him with a guy who was a law student who continued his law work while he was doing this, and he was a lot more, you know, he was younger, he was a lot sort of with it. I think he really had a good rapport with the students themselves. And it was in that period that they started the Chavis House. They didn't call it that. They called it the Minority Student Center. They'd started SABU in the period before that, which is a student association for black unity. And they'd had regular dances. You know, you can imagine the problems that, you know, being an all-male campus with few black students on it was part of the problem with social life. What was your social life? And they had started the SABU organization to provide that. They had had some dances. They had tried to, you know, bring in black students from the other women's colleges in the area and things like that. But you're right, Marjorie really was like a second advisor for that whole group. And then Johnny left, and we hired a niece. In fact, the niece came right at the point we'd made the coeducation decision. So mm-hmm. I think she's made a tremendous change. But also, coeducation has. I mean, you can imagine how much easier it is to recruit black students when you've got both sexes on campus mm-hmm. rather than just one, mm-hmm. especially in the South with all of the sort of, you know, social things that were built into that. So we've got what? We've got something like, what do you say, 2%. Minority students now, and you know, that went from like having 4 students to having 40 some. It's been a tremendous change.
Okay, let's make the shift to talking about the long trek towards co-education.
Okay.
You can do this without any questions.
Well, you know, I came in 73. And what I remember in I think it was 74, 75, it might have been 75, the university did a study of whether or not we should go co-ed that Lou Hodges was part of. I think he was chair of it at the time. And Bob Huntley was president, and the decision at that point was no, we're not going to. And I think in a moment, you know, in a way that was a, you know, that was an opportunity of which we could have done things in a much more normal pattern. The fact that schools were single sex was, of course, a historical accident. It had to do with much broader issues of social changes about attitudes to women. Everybody, well, you know, all the Harvard, Princeton, Davidson, everybody was single sex. But in the late 60s and the early 70s, they all changed. They all changed. And Washington and Lee didn't. So when you think about the 10 years beyond 75 to 85, what happened was that we were single sex no longer because of a historical accident. It was choice. And the choice aspect of it becomes something that gets examined and re-examined. What were the reasons for that choice? Was it the loyalty of alums? Was it some very special character of maleness? Was it something that you were offering an alternative that other schools, elite schools, couldn't offer? On the other hand, it also clearly was becoming a liability. Bill Watt will tell you about grants and things that we were simply not invited to participate in because we were single sex, and they didn't want to touch that. It was much safer to go with co-ed schools. And I think ultimately what it ended up doing was, of course, challenging our conception of ourselves. There isn't any doubt about the fact that by the time we made the decision, Washington and Lee had a reputation for being a better school than it actually was. And we were facing the reality that quality was slipping, and that given the demographics that lay ahead of us, we had to make a choice. And the choice was between remaining all male and becoming increasingly a sort of, you know, school with more mediocre students and with a much less selective admission policy. Or, as John Wilson articulated in one meeting I was in, deciding for excellence and deciding that you wanted to be in that top 20 elite ranked liberal arts schools. And it was a very clear decision that was laid out for us. You know, it's difficult in some ways to talk about this in a way that you think other people are going to hear about it, because one of the awkward things is the sensitivity of the men in those last few all male classes, because what they have heard is, you know, that they were dumb and that, you know, we had to bring women in to save the university, and look what they did. Now suddenly we're smart, you know. And that's, of course, a real oversimplification. There isn't any doubt about that. In those last male classes, there were kids as bright as any that we have today. I'll never forget Jack Sharman, who was a Rhodes finalist. Was, you know, to this day, one of the most brilliant people I've ever known, and he was in one of those last classes. But you didn't have to look very far in terms of the statistics to see that if you're talking about the bottom third of the class, it really was a slipping. We were taking people that we would never accept today. And what happened in the classroom as a result of that was that you felt like you had two different groups of students in class. On the one hand, you had people like Jack, who, whatever level you were teaching at, really wasn't high enough. You know, he was always right there ahead of you. And then you had other kids in the class who had no idea what you were talking about and were lost. And that was the only time in my whole teaching career here that I really felt that. When I first came in 73, I was amazed at how bright these kids were, how much work they do, how good they were. And I really felt that in the early 70s. But by the early 80s, it was different. There isn't any doubt about it. And I'll never forget, I had this one class, it was American architecture, and I had two kids in there who flunked the first test. And they both came to see me. They just couldn't understand. You know, they worked so hard, they tried to do this. I ended up tutoring those kids. I never had to do that before. I met with them at least 3 hours a week outside of class. I went over every lecture and every slide with them. I got them to do extra work. I would monitor their reading, have them write little essays after their reading. Before the exams, we would go over outlines that they had made. I mean, that I think back on it about, talk about extra work for the faculty. I did it because these kids really wanted to learn, and they couldn't keep up unless they had that extra thing. What it means in terms of your faculty time, though, is this remedial reading 101? Is that what you want your faculty to be doing? I'll never forget a Board of Trustees member who said to us in one meeting, "What's wrong with this faculty? Don't they believe that mediocre kids need to be educated?" You know, it was like, that's the Roman Heruska, the argument that don't mediocre people deserve to be represented on the Supreme Court? Yeah, well, yes, and there are institutions that are particularly geared to do that. And in fact, all you have to do is look at the difference of Washington and Lee and Hampton Sydney to see the result of that. Hampton Sydney, one time, had the pretense of saying that it was academically just as good as Washington and Lee. They don't say that anymore. What they say is they're the kind of institution that gives somebody a second chance, right? Now, that was the issue. Do we want to change our mission? Do we want to change our whole historical concept of who we are? Or is academic excellence the most important thing for us so that we should make the adjustments to ensure that that's going to happen? And that's the decision the university made. And clearly it was the right one, too.
Well, tell me about
God, this is...
Keep those juices flowing.
Well, one of the things we did... this was in the 80s. I will never forget when Bill Hartog stood in front of the faculty in that great big science room we used to meet in with his flip chart, and he showed us statistically what was happening with the pool of 18-year-olds. And that we were really going to face a drop in the number of 18-year-olds, period. Moreover, a more severe drop in the number of 18-year-olds who traditionally would be going to this kind of college. And then we faced the reality, of course, we were already cutting ourselves out of half the pool. And I think for a lot of people, that was one of the most convincing arguments. It was like, where were your students going to come from? And you know, the reality is we always could have filled a class, but the question was, who do you fill it with? And that reality of declining quality was something, as I said, we were beginning to see in our classroom, too. So the school undertook the whole study to do it. At the time, there were about 8 women on the faculty when we did this, and 2 of us had tenure. Nancy Margan had come 2 years after I did. But there was a 10-year gap between us and the next woman who was eligible for tenure, who was Kathy Koberstein. So when we went co-ed, there were 8 women on the faculty, 2 of whom had tenure. I think only another, I think only another 4 were actually in tenure track positions. The others were temporary. There was a pretty small group. And we decided, I mean, all of us, everybody on the faculty was invited to write our own opinion about the co-education thing. This was a study that was, I think, much more administratively and board-directed rather than more inclusively involved on the campus. I mean, they did ask everybody.
This was under Wilson.
Yeah, okay. Right. Mm-hmm. This is B. When did he come? 82,
I believe.
Yeah. And, Bill Watt once said to me, when I went into the dean's office in 81, and I worked with him for 2 years, and Huntley was first, and then Wilson came after that. But Bill Watt said to me, co-education is necessary. It's going to happen. I just don't want it to happen under me. You know, because he just knew all the work that was going to lie ahead of it. So, you know, he stayed when Wilson came in. He stayed for that first year, and then they hired John Elrod to replace him. So, the actual sort of instigation of it was really Wilson and Elrod. You know, I think there's some kind of comfort there of the outsiders who were doing it, but the faculty were asked to submit their opinions, and we did that. But we also got together as the group of women and had a series of meetings in which we tried to talk and articulate among ourselves what we thought were the most compelling reasons for Washington and Lee to go co-ed. And I remember Jean Dunbar as being terribly articulate in talking about these things. There'd been an incident in the mock convention parade in which one of the floats was from Massachusetts, and it was of a pool table with a girl on the pool table, and guys, fraternity guys, standing around with beer, simulating sex, and the title was "The Gang's All Here," and it was a reference to that very famous Massachusetts rape case that ultimately became the movie that Jodie Foster was in. I mean, clearly bad taste, right? But also inconceivable that it could get into the parade, that it could go down the parade street, that nobody tried to stop it. And for us, that became one incident that marked that there clearly was a gap here in perceptions of what was appropriate. And I think some of that may even have been almost, you know, in a Freudian sense, that sort of, here we were talking about coeducation and these guys were striking back, and, you know, one of the ways that men have traditionally struck back, which is, you know, violence and control. And it was a real ugly thing, believe me. But it was one of the things that sparked these meetings. And I remember Jean saying this, that that in some ways, given the shrinking pool, what had happened was that the people who were choosing Washington and Lee were choosing it in part because they saw it as a safe place that wouldn't challenge their perceptions. I'll never forget one student who said to me what he valued most about the single-sex Washington and Lee was that it was like those New York men's clubs used to be. Yeah? Like those New York men's clubs used to be. There was that sense that you could still safely project yourself back into the past at a time when women weren't equal players, when they weren't challenging men roles, when men were in control and in charge and knew it and very comfortable with their old boy clubs. And the idea that somehow Washington and Lee had become an old boy club for some of these students, you know, it was safe. And they could do those boys will be boys things without anybody challenging them or saying that this is inappropriate. And in that sense, I think it was breeding some really negative things within the community. We tried to articulate that for the trustees. I'm not sure that it sold anybody on it. In fact, in some ways, I think some of the trustees probably would have said, yeah, that's right. No, but whenever you say that, you got to balance it with the other side, too. Because there isn't any doubt about for every kid who felt that way, there were probably two kids who would have been shocked that somebody felt that way. Just for all of the kids that couldn't make the grade at the bottom of that thing, there were, you know, plenty at the top who were representing the finest traditions we ever had. So it's like anything, in any period, as you try to retell the story, it's so easy to try to tell it black and white. It's so easy to try to tell it as, you know, right and wrong. And the reality is, you know, history's always a lot messier than that. But there are always multiple discourses going on at any single time. And at the same level, conflicting ideas that all equally have their own valid stance. And I think that was very clear at the time we were debating the coeducation stuff. The one thing that was absolutely clear, though, was that we had two traditions. One was academic excellence, and one was being all male. And we had to choose between them, because you couldn't go on having both. And to its credit, when they surveyed the alumni made it very clear that they did value academic excellence over the all-male character at the university. And that's another kind of very special character at this place. And then ultimately the board made the same decision too. That when you came down to it, all the arguments for single sex, whether you want to talk about, you know, the fraternity system, the athletics, the tradition, all the rest of it, none of them actually held up. The only thing that really held up was that feeling inside the heart, that resistance to change, that feeling that there was something so special here that we were losing it. And that was the hardest and most painful thing for those people. But they did it. And there's no doubt at all that they were right to do it. And all you got to do is look around at what's happened to us since then to know how right it was.
Take me to July 14th,
1984. Actually, I was sitting in a friend's house. We were watching the TV because we knew that the news conference was going to going to come on, and there it was, and they were in the Commerce School, and President Wilson, and I remember Chris Compton from the board were there, and they came in and made the announcement that Washington and Lee was going to go co-ed. And, oh, we all just whooped and hollered, and it was wonderful. And interesting, Compton, who was a Supreme Court justice on the Virginia State Supreme Court at the time, said that, you know, he had earlier been one of the people who had opposed the idea, but that that he was persuaded by the arguments, and that the board had decided that this was the right thing to do, and there was no appeal. I thought that was a wonderful sort of legal thing there, right? There wasn't any going back. We were doing it. The arguments, the study was done, the vote was taken. Now what we had to do is go forward. I can't remember the actual day of the conference. It might have been on a weekend. I think it might have been a Saturday. Mm-hmm. On Monday morning, President Wilson called a bunch of us into a room that formed the beginnings of the planning committee of, okay, we've made the decision, what do we do next, and how does it happen? Well, luckily the admissions people had already had anticipated this. They had a mailing ready to go and a late call on the College Board things, and it was startling how quickly that happened. They were all a little scared, you know. It was like they, and especially when you think what they were asking admissions to do, they had to have a class for that following fall. I mean, we made that decision in 84. By the fall of 85, they had to enroll supposedly, you know, 100 students. Well, they very conservatively were saying, well, we'll aim for 100 women, but, you know, we might get 80. Between July and December, when early decision was made, they accepted 39 women applicants. I mean, the amazing thing was how quickly it happened. In fact, my favorite one was one of the former trustees who had opposed the decision on Monday morning called up the president and said, I want my granddaughter to come for an interview. And that was Lucy Anderson, and she was part of that early class. She ultimately went through and not only was an undergraduate major here, she also ended up graduating from law school, too. And so, you know, that had always been part of it, that the trustees not only had sons, they had daughters. They not only had grandsons, they had granddaughters. And they were sending them to us. It clearly was happening. Hartog told me the other day that they had 600 women applicants for those positions that they had. We ended up enrolling, I think, 110 freshmen that year. We also had a small number of transfer students. I think there were about 8 that we took. And we were happy to have them because then they came in and helped us as dorm residents, resident advisors within the dorms. We had just enough to go around, and they were willing to do that to help us out. So we had some older, you know, more experienced women who were transferring in from some other schools. But by and large, it was a decision that we were going to gradually add women to the student body. And the idea was that you would do it with about 100 in each entering freshman class. We were about 1,300 undergraduates at that point. And the idea was that you would gradually build it up and that until you had 1,000 men and 500 women. Well, long before the 10-year projection that was what we were going to do, we'd gotten to the point where we had more than that, and they adjusted at that point to 1,600. And even that, you know, admissions is not an exact science. So what we've got now is what, 630-40 women, something like that. It actually is exactly a 60-40 ratio, was last year anyway. But as President Wilson said to me at the time when I said, what? Quota systems? What are you talking about? And he said, this is the process of evolution, not revolution. And that's the way Washington Lee has always done things. Maybe that's part of the Southern thing, too, that you gradually did this. And, you know, the argument was, we're not going to take more women than we are prepared to deal with. That we've got to do this gradually to make sure we're doing it right. And in some ways, I think that there's good evidence that that was a pretty successful strategy. What happened in that Monday meeting I was referring to was that I was named as the chair of the Coeducation Steering Committee. I also thought that was terribly funny because in 1981 when I became, do you need to change it? When I became associate dean in college, I was the first woman administrator they had ever had. And so when they made that decision in 84, I was the only woman administrator they had on the staff. And I often joked that, you know, they looked around and saw that I was the only woman administrator they had and knew immediately they had to have some more. And they did. Almost the next decision, one was to upgrade Julia Kozak's position, which she had been essentially secretarial staff rank, upgrade it to assistant director of admissions, which is what she'd been doing all along. At the time when Farah had been ill, she'd run the place. I mean, I think she should have had that position a long time before that. But anyway, so she got into professional position. We hired Anise McLeod, we hired Anne Shore Lamont, we hired Cinder Rankin, all of these women that immediately came in on administrative levels and helped us shape that. So we had this this coeducation steering committee, and our job, according to the president's charge to us, was to look into every aspect of the university's operation to decide what the impact of coeducation would be.
Need to flip the tape.